When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here with
Scott Tobias,
Rachel Handler,
and
Keith Phipps.
And behind the boards, as usual, Genevieve Kosky. We all firmly believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current release. This week, I fain would give to thee a pair of period pieces about good, evil, self-righteousness, and murder as we consider two dread-soaked movies where Christianity and paganism face off, and neither one winds up looking blameless or blessed. Rachel, dost thee ken wondrous well what we be about this e'en?
Yeah, you have not put in the 5 years of research necessary to earn talking like that. But writer-director Robert Eggers did for his debut film, The Witch. The film is set in 1630s New England, and Eggers took the archaic dialogue and the situations directly from documents from the era in order to make the film more realistic, which is an interesting goal for a feature about a Puritan family banished to the wilderness and fighting both a supernatural force and their own paranoia and superstition. This week, we're going to examine what's going on in The Witch and see how it contrasts with another film about superstition, paranoia, exile, and fervent religious beliefs, the 1973 cult classic The Wicker Man, written by playwright Anthony Schaffer and directed by Robin Hardy. So, Tasha, I assume we're going to find out how to get burned.
Oh, good Lord, no. That's from the terrible 2006 remake of The Wicker Man starring Nicolas Cage. We'll be bringing that film into the conversation as well, just because it fits so well with some of the things we want to address about how The Witch, the original Wicker Man, and religion in general have all addressed topics like women, sexuality, self-denial, and freedom. But our primary aim here is to look at how Robin Hardy's film and Robert Eggers' film both deal with dread, with history and authenticity, and especially with music. Now please join me in jumping naked through this fire we've kindled in the podcast studio for parthenogenesis purposes. We're going to go back in time to see what fundamentalism and polytheism in American England have to say to each other. The Wicker Man is one of those nearly-didn't-happen films that we're lucky to have gotten at all. It's a weird, idiosyncratic movie by a first-time director who trained as an abstract fine artist in Paris and was looking to get in film primarily as a day job to support himself. It was financed by a young millionaire looking to salvage the failing British film studio he had just taken over and looking for a cheap shocker that could be shot quickly to prove that he hadn't just bought the studio to strip mine its assets. By the time the film was finished, the studio had been sold to EMI, and director Robin Hardy had the film taken away from him by a studio head who felt that The Wicker Man was trash. Around 20 minutes of the movie were cut against Hardy's will, it was barely marketed or released, and to the extent it was marketed, it was as a horror film. The Citizen Kane of horror movies, to be exact. In that last respect, The Wicker Man has some similarities with Robert Eggers' movie The Witch, currently in theaters and currently laboring a bit under the weight of the buildup that typed it as the scariest film out of Sundance. In both cases, viewers had been promised they were about to see something that would pin them to their seat backs in terror, came away somewhat baffled by what they actually got. But in both cases, they also came away with an ending that's hard to shake and with a creeping sense of dread. In spite of its troubled beginnings, The Wicker Man has lingered on for decades, on the edge of cult filmdom, largely on the strength of that ending and of a stellar performance by Edward Woodward, that's interestingly difficult to say, as Scottish policeman Neil Howie. In the film, Sergeant Howie receives an anonymous letter warning him that a child has gone missing on the private island of Summer Isle. He flies out in a seaplane and begins to interrogate the residents, but their responses are contradictory and often easily and quickly revealed as lies. Before long, the pagan rituals he witnesses and the evidence of pagan belief around him convince him that the girl was either murdered as a sacrifice or is being held somewhere in preparation for one. His self-righteousness and anger carries him through the hunt to that unforgettable ending, which, frankly, there is no way to fully discuss The Wicker Man without revealing. So if you haven't seen the film, we honestly advise you to go watch it and come back to this podcast later. But the strength of the film isn't just in the big reveal. Hardy and sleuth playwright Anthony Schaefer adapted David Pinner's book Ritual for The Wicker Man, and they took from the book a depth of knowledge about England's centuries of polytheistic culture and nature worship and the rituals around it, particularly around fecundity and sympathetic magic. There's a haunting quality to the film's specific and repetitious use of music. There's a frank sexuality hanging over The Wicker Man, inspired by fertility rites, and focused specifically to contrast with Sergeant Howie's virginal, austere morality and self-control. The film is memorably lurid, hitting an apex when Britt Eklund's character dances naked in an attempt to lure Sergeant Howie into breaking his Christian vows. And there's a primal terror hanging over the film, not just of sin and death, but an openly religious dread of hell and damnation and the torments of the afterlife. In that respect, the film again has a lot in common with The Witch, with its battle between a cringing Christian family in the 17th century wilderness and the forces stalking them. So, guys, let's talk about this strange, erotic, religious musical from the 1970s and what it has to do with a strange and only somewhat erotic non-musical in theaters right now. We're going to talk in the second half of this week's conversation about whether these films are actually scary and what it says about cinema that's such a contentious topic right now. But I want to start by dialing back a little bit and ask, are these films horror?
I guess they're classified as such. I think the classification for The Wicker Man is folk horror. I think you could probably make the case, a stronger case for The Witch as being horror. There is a genre component there that Eggers, I think, was trying to strike. But I don't think we necessarily need the labels. I mean, I guess I'm going to talk a little bit later about the whole question of is it scary as being an important metric or a valid metric in deciding whether a horror film works, quote unquote, or not. But I think it's more about, if we want to focus on The Wicker Man, really just more about being transported to this very strange, disconcerting place and living within it and taking in whatever ambiance it has to offer you. If you want to call that horror, you can call it horror because it's certainly strange, but it certainly doesn't operate like a normal horror film.
I ask mostly because Robin Hardy has resisted the horror label and has been really uncomfortable with it. I'm wondering if you guys feel uncomfortable with it or you feel it doesn't really matter and it's only a question for the people putting out posters or DVD labels. Like, does it matter to you? Do you walk in with expectations if you're told it's a horror movie?
I do, but I think both of these movies were very much horror films. As a horror fan, I identified them as such and I didn't have a problem putting them in that genre. And they're also my favorite kind of horror films, because they deal with the supernatural's in there, but really it's about the horrible things that people are capable of doing to each other, which to me is always the most frightening. Like, you know, movies like The Shining or Ingmar Bergman, which sort of verge on horror at times, those type of really dark human nature films. Those are my favorite types of horror films, and both of these fit that criteria. Jason Kaufman had a great piece on Medium on horror fandom gatekeeping and why we can't have nice things, and talking about how horror is much more expansive than just Saw and Halloween, and it's about sort of lizard brain horror, the fear of the dark, the fear of nature, fear of the unknown, fear of other people. This is all him writing. So to me, that's very, very resonant.
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem calling either of them horror. I think they fit there better than any other genre if we had to put a label on it. And I think they're both tapped into the horror tradition in different ways. More, I guess The Wicker Man's more sort of the uncanny and more like, you know, something you'd see on The Twilight Zone if in that tradition than anything else. But I mean, The Witch has a witch in it, which I think pretty much puts it squarely in the horror genre as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, one of the things that interests me is both of these directors were first-time directors who had no experience with the horror genre and not really any interest in the horror genre, as far as I can tell. Like, Eggers' interest seems to be very much steeped in period and historicity and recreating like a very specific time and place. And as far as I can tell, Robin Hardy's interest was in getting paid. I mean, I read an interview with him where he basically said, I was an artist and I was interested in financing my art and I thought film would be a good way to go into it.
Would that mean then you would credit Anthony Schaefer really with, because you talked in the opening about this incredible depth of knowledge about, you know, centuries of polytheistic culture and nature worship. And I mean, I think there's certainly a lot of that stuff that informs the world of that film and brings it to life in much the same way that Robert Eggers' research brings The Witch to life. But you would credit that more with Schaefer than Hardy's artistry.
I think some of it comes from Schaefer, who seems to have a definite interest in it. A lot of it seems to come from the original book, the David Pinner book. Mm. And I don't know a lot about Pinner, but he does seem to have had a real interest in in folklore and specifically ritual and tradition. The book's called Ritual. I haven't read the book, so I can't tell, but I've read a lot about it. And just as an aside, spoilers for a book from 1967 here, guys. The ending of The Wicker Man, the movie, you know, that indelible ending, is Schaefer's invention. The book ends with the Brett Eklund character equivalent is found horribly murdered, and the Sergeant Howie equivalent leaves. It's not an island, it's a little Cornish town, and he leaves, and it turns out that he's been doing the murders all along because he's got multiple personalities.
No.
And he's horribly divided in his head because he's this devout Christian, but he's got like secret pagan interleanings.
Did Donald Kaufman write the
I am pretty sure that he did, and that it was actually called Ritual of the Three. So you can credit Schaefer with like a lot of the energy and the twists of Sleuth, which is a story I really, really enjoy. So, I mean, the man's got chops. I can't definitively tell you where any particular element came from. Those are just kind of my guesses.
Well, I guess maybe we could talk a little bit about Hardy's contributions, because I think the visual style of the film is compelling, and it almost reminds me, it seemed almost like Altman-esque in a way, sort of just dropping into this strange world in a very 70s kind of way. It incorporates a lot of the music, you know, you get a sense of the culture of the island. You know, it's not plotty in that sense. I mean, the story does move forward pretty well, but it really is more about getting a sense of what this sort of pagan culture is like, and catching it almost in a not programmatic way, in a very relaxed way that you kind of associate with films in the 70s.
He also, I mean, Hardy really loved his weird angles, his extreme low angles, his extreme high
angles.
And
the bar scene, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of the direction in the film, Rachel?
No, I mean, again, I was brought back to Ingmar Bergman. I kept thinking of that throughout, just the low angles and the sort of very obvious, sort of surreal nature of that. And
it just, I think it's kind of feeds into the sense of the unsettling sense of the experience of the protagonist is kind of thrown into this world that where things are skew. So, you know, makes sense that way.
I mean, it's really rough in places as a directorial experience for me. I guess we should mention that there have been so many different cuts of this film, because there was the original cropped theatrical version. They finally found some of the footage and restored it. There was a director's cut. Then there was what's out now is the final cut, which restored some different footage, but cut some of the director's cut footage. There are 5 different versions of this film. So I don't, like, what version did everybody end up seeing?
The one that Scott
88
sent
minutes.
Me.
I saw the 88-minute version, which I assume is
the
least desirable one.
Yeah. How does it open? Does it open with Howie in church? Or okay,
no.
All right.
It's my version opened, because the version I have is the box set from the 90s that had the theatrical cut and the quote-unquote extended edition. That's how it's labeled. So my version starts with him flying in on a seaplane.
Mine is the final cut, which I believe came out a couple years ago. I got it because it was the one that was on Blu-ray. And it opens. The footage is really rough, but it's good. It opens with Sergeant Howie in church, and like there he's there with his fiance. You see him worshiping. You know, it's probably the most obvious way to establish his piety, but nonetheless, it's a nice atmospheric touch, and you get a look at him. I think it's kind of important to see him before he goes to Summer Isle, kind of see the world he comes from, and rather than just the world he's dropped into.
I almost don't agree with that. And really? My argument against it is we'll get into it maybe a little bit later, is seeing the 2006 remake of The Wicker Man and like, when
that.
The hell are we going to get a Summer Isle? Why are we spending so much time waiting to get there? I like the fact that he's there on a mission. He's got this letter, and then it is revealed to us, I think pretty quickly, that he is pious, that he has these beliefs, and then he's put in this situation that's very uncomfortable to him. And I think the fact that we're thrown into that situation so dramatically really heightens the power of the Brit Eklund dance scene. I think we had too much lead up to that. You know, I don't know. I think we get this. The sweat comes really fast in that scene because we're just like, he's really confronted with something shocking to him and a little bit to us as well. It's a very strange and kind of amazing scene.
So wait. Does the 88-minute version start with him landing on Summer Isle?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Well, I read that Hardy later said that he preferred that he thought the intro was way too obvious and like ham-fisted, the part where they were getting with him on land. But maybe he was just saying that because he couldn't find the longer version or something.
I mean, there's a scene that feels really telling in the extended cut where he's in the seaplane and he comes in, like he's based in the Scottish Highlands, and he comes into the police station and there are a couple of other cops there making fun of him and making fun of the fact that he's saving himself for marriage, that his girlfriend has been like patiently waiting, but they've never had sex. Mm-hmm. And one of them says something like, you know, when they finally get married, she's going to spend more time on her knees in church than on her back in bed. And they guffaw over it. And it becomes this kind of ribald moment that actually really ties in with a lot of what you get on Summer Isle. Mm-hmm. So it makes Summer Isle feel less isolated in that way. It is, and it's more like there are a lot of people in the world that aren't like Neil Howie. I don't know what you get out of that necessarily, but like I appreciated that as a moment.
Well, and he says he's a virgin pretty early on in the 88 book because he tells Britt Eklund's character, he's like, oh, I'm saving myself for marriage. That's how he explains himself.
Yeah, that wasn't in my cut.
Yeah, there's like a really awkward. But also, I read that in your version, she seduces him on the second night, not the first night.
Right.
It felt very abrupt in our version. Like all of a sudden, he just got there and she's seducing him within like minutes of meeting him, and you're like, where did this come from? Like he's not, you know, that hot.
Well, you do get the prelude in the bar though. That
right,
is
right.
So, which again is another but just still, strange it's confusing. And moment in the movie.
I was confused.
Well, okay, the one thing that seems really significant to me that I don't think was in the 88-minute cut is on the first night he goes for a walk and there are people having sex in the fields.
Oh, that no, was that's in it.
That's in that
it.
Was in that there. Was in it. So is the thing where he's in his room and Lord Summer Isle comes to the window and offers Britt Eklund's character a boy?
No.
Because that's also
that's in my cut. I kind of wish it wasn't.
Really? All right. Yeah. So tell me what your reaction was.
I guess my reaction to it is it kind of corrects my reaction to the movie in general, which I think starts and ends wonderfully, and there's a lot of really good stuff in the middle. But whenever there's too much explaining or too much like moving away from his point of view, which that scene moves away from his point of view, and that's kind of my biggest problem with it. And when you get the detailed lineage of Lord Summer Isle and how things happened, I think it's a little bit flat. It's just a little too explainy, but you know, it's more of a quibble than a huge complaint. But yeah, I think the tops and tails of the movie are a lot stronger than the middle.
I would just that one scene though, like so what happens is Lord Summer Isle like comes to Britt Eklund's window and says, you know, I'm presenting this boy to you as a sacrifice to Aphrodite. And she's like, send him on up. And he's maybe 14 and he's very clearly there to lose his virginity.
Right.
And Howie like listens in, there's like moaning from the next door.
Wow.
But what's more significant is the boy passes through the bar downstairs and there's complete silence as he passes through. And then he goes upstairs and you know, the guys who are always hanging out at the bar singing,
yeah,
start singing this song that's basically about a boy having his first sexual experience. And the faces, this is one of the moments that strikes me most of the entire movie, is all of them are looking up at the ceiling. All of them are thinking about what's going on in this room. And they all have this just, you say ew, but they all have this just like soft, gentle, nostalgic look on their face. Like they're all there with them in the room. And it's maybe the only moment in the film, apart from the horrible singing and dancing at the end where everybody's so happy, where you actually feel like they're a community. And not just a community, but that there's joy in this paganism that isn't like heavily, heavily creepy. This is only kind of creepy.
Just slightly, yeah.
Well, anyway, I do kind of want to talk a little about the rough edges in The Wicker Man, because I do feel it's a flawed film. Like, I mean, do you want to get into any specifics, Keith? Is there any particular scene that you think just goes on too long?
I mean, the one I always have trouble with is one where Lord Summer Isle, like I said, is explaining things, which I don't know how you, that's important information to get in there, but it seems to be it's conveyed in the most pedestrian way possible. No offense to Christopher Lee, who's a great actor. It just kind of like, there seems to be like all this intrigue and what is going on here and what's happening. And then in one scene, it's like, here's what's going on here and what's happening. It's a little too much too quickly, I think.
No.
All right.
Well, I think Christopher Lee is just so perfect in the role, and he delivers all this information with such kind of like wit that just kind of, I guess it kind of dances on camp a little bit, but in that delicious Christopher Lee way. I like it. It's good information, and I think it's delivered in a cinematic way. I mean, he gives you sort of a tour of the estate, and it gives, you know, a really, I guess, iconic, I hate using that word, but iconic actor a little bit of room to breathe and make his sort of presence known. I like all that stuff.
Okay.
But I don't have any issues. Maybe the problem is I don't really have a whole lot of problems with the film. I don't feel like it sags at all in the middle.
I don't want
all
to overstate
the stuff, all the stuff that Howie discovers is fascinating to me and reveals all these new facets about the way this island works. So
I gotta say, the scene where he goes to the library and reads out loud to us on paganism is the 1973. It's such like interesting and useful information, and every single bit of it's used, but it's still exactly the 1973 equivalent of a scene today where Bella sits down at her computer and looks up vampires.
Yeah. That's the other one I was gonna say. Okay.
I'll concede that.
But that's like Suspiria. Suspiria has one of those scenes too, where it's like, you know when to go to the bathroom in Suspiria, because it's like you're at a university and the guy's going to talk for like 15 minutes.
What is witches? Let us tell you what witches is. Rachel, I feel like the two of us may either like deadlock or decide it one way or the other on Christopher Lee. I find him just painfully camp.
Oh, and yeah.
I find him hilarious in this film, but like, what's your take on Christopher
Lee? No, I agree. But I think it's hard to divorce him from like all the other stuff that he's done. Maybe that's particularly why. But I agree. I mean, he was delightful and funny. And that made his character, I think, even more sort of horrifying, because he's basically admitting that he's tricking all of these people into, you know, doing all this insane pagan stuff, like burning down strangers, just like for his own. Yeah, spoiler.
Whatever.
For his own glee? I don't know.
Is there ambiguity there to this movie? Is there like sort of like, yeah, it's sort of, it's a deception, but it seems to work for everyone.
But he admits that he's like, everyone thought it was the gods, but we just planted some fruit.
Sure.
He right. Really? Straight up
is that
says
how you
that.
Interpret that?
Yeah,
he's all right, I'm really curious about this. Like, do you all think that he's just faking, that he's playing them?
I thought so.
No, I didn't think so. Huh. But am I wrong?
Is he a true believer in paganism? I got the sense that he wasn't.
That he wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
again, this is sort of a moment where one of the cut scenes, because immediately after he says,
we're all going to see different movies.
Version, in my version, he says, I'm totally a pagan for sure. Really, what? Guys. And holds up a sign that says 100% pagan. No, he after he sends the boy up to Eklund, he has this little bit of poetry that he reads literally while watching snails have sex. Sorry, explicit tag. While watching
that
would have
been worth the explicit tag. Yeah. I guess.
While watching a pair of snails engaged in Congress of a Personal Nature, he recites this little poem about the beasts of the field and how they are not proud and they bend their knee to no master. And it really feels felt to me.
Pray do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. Not one of them kneels to another or to his own kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one of them is respectable or unhappy. All over the
earth. I mean, I assumed he was a true believer.
Well, I guess it goes back to, that's the question underneath the whole movie, is how much of it is a performance for Howie and how much of it is actually how they're acting all the time.
They kind of commit to what they believe in. I mean, I think it's a super interesting question because, if you look at Eggers the Witch, obviously this is a very believing community, but like even they have apostates, basically. In any religious community, there's somebody who's just kind of crossing their fingers and gritting their teeth and going with it.
Right.
There's not really a sense of like outsiders here. Everybody's in on the conspiracy. And nobody warns him. Like nobody says anything to him.
Right.
They're all down.
Paganism rocks.
Yeah, I think they're happy. I mean, come on. It seems like a lot of
fun. Seems awesome.
They get pretty much all the field sex and fire jumping anybody could possibly want.
I'm like, what's wrong exactly?
Well, I mean,
I'm a pagan now, guys.
This is the film that converted you. Was it this or The Witch?
No, it was this one. Made it seem way cooler.
I mean,
there is the matter of sacrificing.
Right, but so
perhaps we have some moral qualms
it's
about
fine.
That.
But
I mean, that guy was a prig anyway. Well, let's talk about... But
no,
true.
You're right.
He's
a jerk. Let's talk a little about him. I think one of the most interesting things in the movie is how your sympathies shift throughout this film. I mean, nobody deserves what happens to him, but he kind of deserves what happens to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, how do you feel about kind of how that character changes over the course of the film?
You know what this film, I'm going to compare it to another film. That's my only way of thinking about it, is you've seen the film Seconds, the John Frankenheimer film Seconds. If for those who have not, it stars Rock Hudson as a guy who changes his identity quite literally and goes from being this guy from upstate New York who is just living a normal suburban life to being, you know, an artist on the coast who's living sort of a hippie life, or whatever counted for hippies, and what it would be 1966.
It was mid-60s. Yeah, there was a counterculture.
Sure, there was a counterculture. So he, and there's a scene that reminded me so much of the May Day stuff in The Wicker Man, where they're crushing grapes, and it's like this, it's this super intense scene, and, you know, very sexual, and very, you know, and it's shocking to him, because his conscience is still stuck in uptight upstate New York. He's not used to seeing this, and the position, I think, both The Wicker Man and Seconds takes is somewhere in the middle of these two worlds, in my opinion. I don't see it as being an endorsement or taking sides with one aspect or another. I think it just gets you into that situation and it allows you to kind of live in the ambiguity of it rather than necessarily have you feeling definitively on the side of the Summer Isle people or definitively on the side of this, you know, investigator.
I'm going to defend Howie. Because, yeah, he is sort of a, you know, uptight prig, self-righteous, but everything he does is motivated by what he feels is his need to unravel the mystery of a girl who's either dead or missing. And I think, you know, his motives are ultimately good. And he goes about it in a way that takes no respect for the people he encounters or tries to impose his view of the world on a place that does not want to take it. But his heart is in the right place. So, yeah, let's have and he is also not a hypocrite. So let's have some respect for Howie.
He's kind of a hypocrite, I think.
How so?
I mean, there's that line where he and Lord Summer Isle are talking and he's like, what's going on? Why are those people jumping over the fire? And he says they're trying to get pregnant without sexual union. And he says, he's like, what? That's crazy. And then Summer Isle is like, no, like that's what happened with Jesus, basically, is their interaction. And his motivations are, on a surface level, he's trying to find this girl, but I think it's actually about this fear of exposing his religion as false, or he's confronted with, probably for the first time, people who don't believe in Jesus and don't believe in this exact form of religion that he's so strictly followed his entire life. So I think a lot of what motivates him is just to sort of convince himself and convince these people that they're bad and wrong and that he's right.
I think that's a spillover, though, from the main quest, which is, again, looking for a girl who's gone missing that nobody else seems to be concerned about looking for, and pushing through with that despite the indifference and opposition of everyone he encounters. So, you know, I don't necessarily think that being confronted with inconsistencies is the same as being a hypocrite. I think he behaves in a consistent manner.
Well, I'm not saying it's hypocritical in that it's inconsistent. I'm saying he's calling them insane for believing in something and that he believes in something just as ridiculous, you know, in theory. I'm not hating on
all
Christianity.
Our Christian listeners.
I'm a pagan, but I still believe in I'm Jewish.
How much parthenogenesis is there in the Jewish religion?
So much. We can't talk about it, though.
Do you want to jump through this fire over here, or do you not want to be pregnant right now?
See, at the end, this reminds me of that scene in Hail Caesar. At the end of the scene, you'd say, eh.
I'm the rabbi in Hail Caesar.
That was fun. Yeah, they specifically target Howie because he's so self-righteous and he's so stiff-necked that they know he's going to charge through all of this. Like anybody sensible would say, all right, I need to leave now. Like I am alone in this situation. I'm clearly being lied to. Everybody is against me. And it's his sheer arrogance that makes him keep going. I think that you're right and that he has a solid motivation. He really is worried about this girl. But so much of that comes from a place of like moral self-righteousness and superiority. And I think that's not only part of what makes him unlikable in a way that makes the story interesting, but it also, I mean, it enables everything that they do to him.
I think he just really just needs to get laid. That's the problem with Howie.
Well, that would fix a lot of problems, including what happens to him in the end, because he wouldn't be any good to them. I mean, for me, the fact that they throw Britt Eklund at him super hard is indicative that, like, they really do give him a chance. I mean, they give him a chance to forswear himself, but they give him a chance to get out of what's done to him, and he doesn't take it. And it's really difficult. And you can kind of have some respect for him there, you know, given what he turns down and how hard he works at it. Or can you? Like, I don't know. I'm not a red-blooded American male. Like,
yeah. No, I mean, I respect, I suppose.
Idiocy?
Good work. I don't know why you would do that. But
because of God.
That scene, yeah. I mean, I've liked this film quite a bit. I'm a cult movie person. I've studied that sequence quite a bit.
What is that gesture that you're making right now, Scott?
I don't know. But it's I'm just completely red in the face now. But I think that the film has an erotic component. I will say that is an understatement. And that scene is certainly, that comes through in about as powerful a way as cinema even has to offer. I mean, that's pretty much, other than the ending, maybe the most memorable sequence of the film. And also, I think, is one where, again, Robin Hardy kind of comes through directorially. I mean, it's a very boldly staged sequence. Just the way she dances is so unusual and seductive, and then there's a part of it where she's just looking directly into the camera, which is that's a huge risk to sort of break the fourth wall, but it takes the viewer out of voyeuristic position and kind of engages them in a very exciting sort of way. Mm-hmm. That's all in the direction.
I would say Britt Eklund's presence might have a role in the way
Britt Eklund and her body doubles. I mean, two body doubles.
But, were there two? I knew that there was a butt double because Hardy didn't like her butt.
I thought she didn't
she was
like
pregnant
her
though. I think she was. I think she was like 3 months pregnant.
Oh wow!
Which I wouldn't think would show very much, but still, I think that was.
Well, on a body that small, it might.
Yeah. So I think she was. I think there were two body doubles.
Oh, that's incredible! Yeah. I didn't realize that.
And again, I did not know that until looking it up. It was so.
No,
it's seamless
I
in
that
respect.
Either. Yeah.
Yeah, that's. I mean, that's pretty impressive. Like shooting around that without it being noticeable. I mean, I never would have known because that scene is so confrontational. I mean, she is so aggressive, and that's, I think, part of what makes it exciting. I would think, especially in the 70s, there's something like coy and playful about it, as a lot of the sexuality is in the movie. But it's also, I mean, she's throwing herself out there.
Well, is it also, too, on the other side, because we talk about his piety. I mean, isn't also about her asserting their lifestyle as being superior as well.
Oh, absolutely.
In that sequence, you get a sense of the central spiritual conflict of the film. I mean, it could not be expressed in a stronger way. I mean, that of you know, sin and temptation and whatever. I mean, that's all comes to the fore. And I guess maybe I should, Keith, respect him more than more than I have for turning that away.
Well, it's a power play. I mean, as you said, you know, it's a way to assert their way of life as superior to his. It's not necessarily about any of the reasons, apart from the obvious, any of the reasons why this man with his beliefs would want to have sex in the first place.
Well, there is a degree in the movie to which, like, Lord Summerisle represents the intellectual side of paganism, and she's just, like, purer. The pure animal side. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think you get out of his little speech about, you know, the beauty of the animals and how they bend the knee to no one is he's talking about just kind of the primal power of doing whatever you want, which is, I mean, part of the kind of the paganistic, the polytheistic, the satanistic, like all of these religions are kind of wound up in nature respect and nature worship. And part of that is like worshiping natural urges and lusting after Britt Eklund is a pretty natural.
Making Christopher Lee's character, Lord Summerisle, the intellectual pagan, and Britt Eklund's character, the sort of the lusty, animalistic side of paganism. Are these progressive gender politics, or what are we looking at here?
I mean, it's not just a gender thing. It's also an age thing.
Sure.
Like in the scene where he's singing to Ingrid Pitt, I think her name is, the school teacher, about like they're singing a lusty song about a hardy blacksmith, which there is no traditional song about a blacksmith that is not about sex. Okay, except Blacksmith of Brandywine, which is about killing. But there might be some sex under there. Mostly it's about sex. And they're singing the song and it's clearly foreplay. Like there's a sexual side to him, too. There's a seductive side. But like in part, it's just she's young and beautiful and he gets the sense of like old and like he's had his time. But I mean, I don't know. No, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I'm thinking about it now, and I'm trying to think about how the 2006 version made them all women, and Ellen Burstyn was Summer Isle, and I think they tried. I don't know what they were trying to say, but ultimately it was like, careful, if women get too much power, like, here's what'll happen. That was like the ultimate message of that Wicker Man.
I'm just thinking about Christopher Lee as old and past his prime in 1973, and then he worked for another 45 years.
Right.
I know, but he didn't get many sexy leading man roles, did
he? Well, he does dress as a woman at the end. I don't know what the significance of that might be.
Oh, it's the primal man-woman image, as explained to us in the library Google scene.
See, I shouldn't have, maybe I just zoned out during that whole thing and thought it was good, but they do explain what every little what every costume person means, don't they?
It's Chekhov's reference check or something.
Well, we definitely should talk at least a little about the 2006 Wicker Man, and I believe we have a 2006 Wicker Man virgin in the room.
That's right.
I watched it last night.
Both of you, for the first time,
Sergeant Howie of the 2006 Wicker Man.
Oh my God! Confronted by the naked Brett Eklund of Nicolas Cage screaming.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I certainly knew about the memification of this movie. I'd seen all of the clips, all the relevant clips. You know, How to Get Burned and Step Away from the Bike, which is my favorite. Why do people? That's an underrated one. Step Away from the Bike with him holding the. And
you won't bring back
your bees, which is not even in the movie.
My bees,
But I think all of that just gets in the way of discussing just how purely craptastic this thing is. And it has to be like one of the most misogynist films I've ever seen in my life. You know, because it transforms, of course, this Summer Isle is now this horrible matriarchal society that Nicolas Cage has to punch his way through. You know, I cannot believe that it got made. And it makes me feel retroactively ashamed for sticking up for Into the Company of Men, which a lot of people attacked for being a sort of a misogynist film, because I felt like, hey, that's totally within the world of
You should spell business. Out the connection.
They're both directed by Neil Abute.
Still, I think you're okay to defend. I mean, that's portrayal is not endorsement, this is not.
No, but this is every single decision that is made is wrong. I mean, you get like 15 or 20 minutes before you even get to Summer Isle.
I think setting it, I don't think that this makes sense in America. Part of what makes the original Wicker Man so powerful is like sort of the sense of returning to what was there before Christianity, what was there before what Sergeant Howie believes in kind of swept in and washed all this away, or did it wash it all away? Did it all just kind of go underground? I mean, there's so much, they don't get into it that much, but I mean, so much of our Christian holidays that we celebrate, sorry, Rachel.
I celebrate them too, it's fine.
We as a culture celebrate in general are co-opting of pagan holidays, you know, either the time or it's, you know, the rituals involved in them, you know, from the Christmas tree to, you know, various things we associate with Easter. So there's kind of a sense that like, it's kind of the return of the repressed. If you set this in England, if you set it in America, I don't know that it works that well.
At least he, you know, reconceptualized it as something as repulsive as that concept.
Sure.
Is. The other thing that bothers me about it, and this is a fundamental thing, is that Neil Abute is just not a sensualist in the way that Rob. I mean, you know, you enter the world of Summer Isle in the original Wicker Man. It's so fascinating and enveloping and immersive. And Abute just doesn't have that skill. I mean, he doesn't have that skill. He's a writer primarily. I think as a director, you know, he shows his limitations with Wicker Man, but I really want to know what I've talked and talked because I'm just this film is I saw it this afternoon and it's just I can't stop getting angry about
Scott
it.
Scott actually came in and said as we're setting up the podcast came in and said he'd seen the movie for the first time this time and I said you're not allowed to say another word. I want the full core dump
this is
on
like, this
mic.
Was like this was a this was like an explosion of intensity, but I want to know what Rachel thought of this
me
film.
Too.
It was hilarious. I was laughing out loud for a really good portion of the film.
The beginning of it?
Not in the beginning.
The last 30 minutes are hilarious.
Hilarious. Yeah. I think that's what stuck with me is I couldn't stop laughing for a long time. I was like, this is amazing. It was horribly misogynistic. It was incredibly poorly done. Nicolas Cage was completely tonally off in every single scene. The flashbacks were absurd. And the thing with the girl in the car, then like she exploded into bees. I was just like, what is going on in this movie? It was so tacky and just poorly handled and lazy. And God, it was just embarrassing for everyone involved. I don't know. But mostly I was stuck with by the end, I was just delighted by the entire thing.
Hmm. Did you see, this is a problem that I always have when I walked away from that film so like overwhelmed by how openly and grossly misogynistic it was.
It was bad.
That it was hard for me to laugh at it. And because I love the Wicker Man, the original Wicker Man, so much that, I mean, this was like watching somebody take like your beloved stuffed animal that you've had since you were an infant and defecate on it and then jump up and down on it a few times. So like, it was hard for me to just like laugh at it openly. Did any of the politics of it,
oh my God, it
ruin
me.
It for you?
I mean, it was horrifying. I was like, I literally can't believe this movie was made and people didn't raise a question about what it was saying about women and what happens when women get power. Did they cut out the men's tongues?
Like, heavily implied.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean, it was just horrifying.
What was the casting sessions even like for this thing? Like, Ellen Burstyn and
Lily
Sobieski and Molly Parker. It's like, okay, here's the deal. This is about how horrible things would be if women were in charge. Can you please be in our
They're
movie?
Like, sounds great. Amazing.
I will offer a very feeble defense of what they're doing here.
How exciting.
No, the movie doesn't work at all, but perhaps the idea is to offer sort of a funhouse mirror as sort of like, you know, patriarchy is awful. What if it swung the other way? It might look a little bit like this, you know? I don't know.
It's like, it's bad.
The problem is we don't get a sense of the patriarchy. We have to bring that in with us.
Yeah. I'm exasperating myself.
It is.
But I've been doing for things so over the top and arch that it almost, you know, you are kind of horrified and amused. It's you're not going to mistake it for anything that I can't. I give up.
I have heard the argument that, you know, LaBute is in on the joke, and I think maybe you could extend him a certain amount of
he doesn't get to be in on the joke.
Latitude is that?
It's not his joke.
You know, like, have a woman make that joke. Then
that's a really good point. But there's also just, I could see how in the hands of completely different actors and maybe a better director and with a better script, that theory could work fine. Mm-hmm. For me, one of the biggest problems of the film beyond Nicolas Cage is Kate Behan. She is so vapid. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that makes the original Wicker Man work for me is it is the rare conspiracy movie where the conspiracy holds up, where it doesn't fall apart at the end, where you don't wind up saying there's no way two people in power could have done all that, or that the conspiracy could have gotten on the other side of the world that quickly. Everybody's in on the planning, and that's what makes it work. They're all manipulating him. They all know what the game is. In the 2006 version, the main carrier outer of the conspiracy is this woman who doesn't look like she has two brain cells to rub together. Yeah. She spends so much of the movie, he asks her a question and her response is, durr. I mean,
but maybe I thought she was kind of doing that on purpose because she just didn't know.
But it doesn't matter if she's doing it on purpose. Right. It's so boring.
No, it is. And also it's crazy that the fact that she was just like shrug emoji when he asked her why she did this to him. I was like, that's all we're going to get.
I cannot think of a better way to transition out of this podcast for this episode than shrug emoji. All right. So the 1973 Wicker Man, Burning Man emoji, the 2006 version, shrug emoji. All right. So we'll get a little more into Wicker Men in general and how they contrast with The Witch in part two of this conversation. But first, we'd like to share some of the excellent listener feedback we got on our last episode comparing the Coen brothers, Barton Fink and Hail Caesar. We got quite a few really terrific letters responding to this episode, but some of them were really long. So instead of spending the next half hour reading all of them, we're going to give you some excerpts and post the rest at nextpictureshow.net. Rachel, you want to kick us off with a little feedback?
Here's one from Jason Eakin in Los Angeles, who suggests we miss some of the morality in Hail Caesar because none of us are practicing Christians or Catholics and we're all pagan. Jason writes, as a Christian, it's very easy to see Eddie Mannix as a Christ figure. One of Mannix's primary roles as a studio bigwig is that in his pursuit to produce good movies, he has to deal with countless scandals of actors, directors, writers. They confess to him, ask for his help, essentially unburdening themselves and putting the weight onto his shoulders. To take the idea further, we see him on the phone to the head of the studio. Naturally, the studio head can be seen as God, with Mannix's Christ figure as the embodiment of the studio's will, in the same way that Christ came to earth as God in the flesh. I'll leave the Holy Spirit out of this for now, although a sneaky argument could say it's the magic of the movies. So when Mannix goes to confession, it might not actually be the weight of his own trifles that he's actually there for. It's because of the weight of all of the burdens he's had to bear on behalf of his subjects. This certainly plays into his decision to stay at the studio instead of taking an easier job. He feels what we Christians might refer to as a calling to bear the sins, scandals, and chaos of the movie business and try to find a way to make something meaningful out of it. In other words, to redeem it.
That's a really good point. I kind of regret us not. I mean, we can only do so much, I suppose. But the spiritual aspect of Hail Caesar is important and is a big part of a lot of the Coen Brothers films, particularly lately. I guess I refer you to Film Spotting proper. Did an episode on Hail Caesar that really gets into it and is terrific. So if you want more on that, I would recommend our sister podcast, Film Spotting.
And we always recommend Film Spotting. However, before we get too deeply into that filter, we have a suggestion of another filter through which we could see the movie. Scott, you're up.
Cole Bauer from Minneapolis writes, "The richness of Barton Fink really does lie in the layered complexity with which the Coen brothers have constructed a story worthy of numerous thematic interpretations. I saw it through a queer lens. A case could be made that Barton was really struggling with repression of sexuality and sexual identity. Subtle visual cues give evidence, such as the moment when Charlie shows Barton how to wrestle, and Barton subsequently lets his head rest on Charlie's shoulders, or Barton finding comfort in the fact that he happens to have Charlie's shoes. Overt clues and dialogue further tie things in, such as the numerous references of Barton's work being quote-unquote fruity to the detectives questioning Barton, quote, 'You two have a sick sex thing?' With which Barton answers with fading incredulousness, 'Sex? He's a man. We wrestled.' It doesn't take very much here to connect wrestling with homosexuality, and Barton's struggle to write such a film is as much a struggle to actually write a wrestling picture as it is to struggle with his possible avoidance and repression of his sexual identity as a gay man. Even his intimate moment with Audrey reinforces this struggle. As many gay men attempt relationships with women to reinforce a false identity of straightness or see it as a possible cure-all to attractions towards men, Audrey's death epitomizes the struggle with what is expected to what is the truth. Her death is the end of Barton's facade of straightness, and with that, his love of Charlie becomes more focused to the point where he doesn't want him to leave and cries upon him doing so. I could go on and on, but the fascination of this film is its invitation to audience participation. Whether my theory holds any water is up for debate, but that's not really the point. The point is that the Coens have made a movie that is so open to audience interpretation and participation that repeat viewings become a must, and enjoyable ones at that. And what filmmaker doesn't want his work seen over and over?"
So we have an argument for the Coens through a religious lens. We have an argument for the Coens through a gay lens or through any personal lens. Keith, what do you have?
Here's one from Andrew Wellman. "As a Coen Brothers fan, I tend to reject the idea that their films need contextualizing. There was an article circulating a couple of months back about references found in the Hail Caesar trailer, which bothered me in that looking for Easter eggs and callbacks in Coen films is largely pointless. After listening to the only DVD commentary track they've ever done for The Man Who Wasn't There, I've tended to operate under the assumption that the primary motivation of the Coens is to create something which amuses them. Therefore, one of the things I like about their films is how self-contained each one of them are. In this day and age of film franchises which deliberately leave loose plot threads and include Samuel L. Jackson epilogues to tease forthcoming films, everything one needs to grasp the substance of a Coen film is contained within the four corners of the movie screen. I've always felt that one of the reasons I tend to rate The Hudsucker Proxy higher than other viewers is that I've never seen His Girl Friday and other films upon which Hudsucker is reportedly based. In certain objections voiced by some, 1930s design set in 1950 simply went over my head. Because of this, I'm not especially compelled by any theory that Barton Fink and Hail Caesar are meant to somehow relate to one another. I don't think that there's any particular deep meaning in the idea that the studio has the same name in both films, other than, going back to my primary Coen theory, is simply amusing the brothers to do this. Accept the mystery."
Okay, so we have the Coens through a religious lens, through a gay lens, through any personal lens, or through no lens. What do we think about all this?
Well, I think the last one sort of shuts things down a little bit more than I would like.
I think it shuts our podcast down. I think it shuts down.
Except the mystery.
Like, you know, no contextualization.
We're about
done.
Us not comparing Barton Fink and Hail Caesar. I'm going to kind of defend us on that front. The idea of accept the mystery is indeed an important one, and I think something we do need to embrace in the work of the Coen brothers. However, that should not keep us from trying to figure out what's going on in them, trying to find some meaning and comparing them. It is significant to me that both films are about Capitol Pictures, for example. It is significant. There are significant callbacks between relations between Hail Caesar and Barton Fink, and Hail Caesar and a bunch of other films that they've done, and Barton Fink and a bunch of other films that they've done. You have to making those comparisons. That's part of assessing careers. That's part of criticism. That's something that we should do. But I think, because I do think accept the mystery is, you know, an important thing ultimately, particularly where the film is mysterious as Barton Fink.
I think see His Girl Friday. It's wonderful.
You're just missing out.
Oh boy, you're going to love His Girl Friday.
Or Sullivan's Travels, for that matter.
And, you know, perhaps you'll see some connections that others have seen. because they are there. I like the other two letters quite a bit. I think that's a very interesting working metaphor for what's going on in Hail Caesar. And I know we touched on the Christian themes, but we probably sold them short a little. You know, a couple people have mentioned, Tom Sharpling among them, have mentioned that, you know, it's sort of the Christian, a serious man, sort of taking the same spirit of inquiry of that film and applying it to Christianity and dropping in an unlikely setting. And I think that is tough to deny with this film. And I think we did touch on this, where I think with the Coens, I don't know that there's necessarily piety or actual faith driving these inquiries, but I think there's a lot of respect for the characters who are searching for these things and using religion to do that.
I'm intrigued by the second letter too, about looking at Barton Fink through a queer lens. I mean, one thing that the letter writer did not mention is his ability to write after he perhaps comes to terms with all these things. Maybe that's what's holding him back. He talks about that letting go a little bit at that moment, and that's the moment that the writer's block goes away and he starts to write.
I mean, I think it's a really interesting lens. I find it a little hard to buy, if only because of the way the sex scene with Judy Davis is shot, the degree that he doesn't seem to go into it, to me at least, like reluctantly or like he's trying to force himself. He doesn't seem like ambivalent or diffident or confused at all. It seems to me like it's shot in a very like gung-ho, go for it kind of way. And it seems to be one of the few moments in the film where he doesn't feel confusion. You know, I know many gay friends who have gone through a phase of, I found a person of the opposite gender who I like, maybe this is me fixing all of my problems. And obviously it doesn't last long. So, you know, maybe it's that. I think this is a real indication that, you know, you really can, if you can't find honest representations of yourself on screen, you can find shadows of yourself on screen in a variety of interesting ways. And you can kind of claim any film you want for your own.
Yeah, I don't think it's the key that unlocks the movie, but I think he points out all the really relevant examples of the physicality and intimacy between the two people as being something that probably hasn't been explored enough when we talked about the movie.
Yeah, it's a great argument. I mean, yeah, it's good evidence for sure.
As always, we love when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. It gives us a lot to think and talk about. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on our website. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll get deeper into The Wicker Man, we'll find out who found the witch scary, and we'll talk about whether that's an important metric, and we'll ask ourselves why kids singing songs is always so damn spooky in movies. You'll also get to hear this.
First search for corn rig on Google is corn rigs and barley rigs. What are they? Yahoo answers, I know that corn rigs are Bonnie and all, but why, how, and what are they?
Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice, and follow us on Twitter at NextPicturePod. So you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, I'm just going to go take this baby and this mortar and pestle into the back room. No particular reason. My skin's just feeling a little dry right now, guys.